in the world patriarchal meant at the time, I certainly knew how to frown whenever I heard a man drown me in machismo and casual sexism. Even so, though I didn't want to hear a lot of the things he had to say about women, I shrugged it off, because as much as he liked to talk, I liked to look at him while he expertly cut my hair. But like Ron, he up and disappeared, leaving my hairline once again in a state of total abandonment. Kim then recommended I go see someone named Jason. I loved Jason because he had a sleeve of arm tattoos that went from his shoulder to his wrist and a quintessential Houston accent, and he read Esquire. In other words, he was the perfect mix of man. Moreover, as talkative as I could be, I could also sit in silence for long periods of time. Jason never tried to force a conversation. If anything, I would push him for small talk, and thankfully, he never made me regret it. Above all, Jason cut hair like an artist, and I always left his chair feeling my most confident. For someone still dealing with weight issues and the occasional taunt about how slanted my eyes were or how big my two front teeth were, those moments of confidence prove vital. Up until college, despite only a few unwanted parts here and there, my experiences with barbershops were mostly fine. That didn't mean I necessarily loved the waiting part before a cut, during which I had been subjected to whatever conversation the men in the room were having. I was not a sports fanatic, but I was competent enough to tolerate those conversations. When it came to politics, even as a teenager, I found myself resisting the urge to correct the much older men who didn't have the slightest clue as to what they were talking about. Then there was the chatter about women, which often had me burying my head in a magazine or aggressively staring into the TV and pretending my senses were strong enough to make out what was being said over the loudness of everyone else. And of course, every so often, I would hear homophobic comments made by men in the barbershop. For many gay black men, the hyper-masculine, ultra-straight spaces of the majority of black barbershops were intimidating because they were so wildly unwelcoming. Even while fighting to admit the truth about myself deep down, I knew much of their musings was intended to make people like me feel less than. I had already been trained on how to ignore things I didn't want to hear due to the chaos in my own home. That's not to say I didn't wince at some points, but I had never been especially bothered until one particular visit. It was my final year of college, so by then, I was already out and becoming more familiar with the art of brushing opinions aside about homosexuality that repulsed me. I went to see my regular barber at the shop located across the street from campus. One of the other barbers started a rant about gay clientele and how they behave while in the chair. In his deluded mind, gay men wanted every single man around, including his booger wolf few clients haven't asked. You know how these faggots get in the chair. They stick their elbows out, hoping to brush against your dick and shit. Punk-ass niggas. His vitriol was met with laughter from much of the room. Everyone, including my barber, joined in on the jokes. My barber in particular yucked it up, extending his elbows and doing what he felt were gay mannerisms to delight of his other barber's stupidity and delusion of grandeur. The barber wouldn't stop his diatribe, going on to add that gay men needed to be rounded up and sent to a woman's prison to be raped. In his mind, that was his way of curing an egregious perversion. He was one of those types who felt homosexuality was a conspiracy concocted by the white man to emasculate the black man. By then, I had already taken a course on gender roles and relations. It was in that class, taught by a professor who looked exactly like my late grandmother, that I learned how most of our ideas of gender and sexuality stem from Western mores and customs that we traditionally had never embraced until they were forced on us through enslavement. I learned a lot about non-European cultures that didn't subscribe to gender binaries and the ways most of us have been conditioned into believing. Above all, I was informed that if not for the imperialistic, Bible-toting, and dogma bastardizing white men who swooped in and forced their rigid nonsense on us through colonialism, maybe, just maybe, this man wouldn't have sounded so damn foolish in the barbershop. Yet, though I had knowledge of all these things, I didn't put up a fight upon hearing this. In that moment, my silence allowed his ignorance to win. It wasn't that I didn't think to say anything. I wanted to, but I didn't want to bother anyone. It wasn't as if I was going to change any of their minds. Anyone who thought that of gay folks would not suddenly alter their point of view simply due to my standing in front of them. Life was not some after-school special. If anything, words would have been exchanged, and that scene could have easily ended up as a story on the evening news. This just in, 22-year-old black Howard student stabs area barber to the white meat for talking out of turn about the gays with his bitch ass. Meanwhile, as all of this was happening, I only had half of my head cut. You could literally see half my head trimmed down, and the other side still in the shape I walked in with. Cursing out someone with trimmers in his hand whose job was to give me a haircut didn't come across as the smartest move to make. So I let them win for the sake of my vanity and lack of faith in my anger management skills. After finishing up, I walked up to the East Towers, the dorm I lived in, and called Jordan, to whom I had talked to every so often. As I was describing everything that had happened, I broke into tears. I knew that man was ignorant and wrong. I knew I wasn't the person he was describing. I bawled anyway. I bawled because, while I was out, I hadn't been out that long. While I wouldn't describe Howard University as overwhelmingly welcoming to gay people at that time, I at least knew how to take care of myself in that environment. But just going across the street reminded me that there was an entire world out there, and a lot of it still didn't support my kind, even if we shared the same skin color. Mostly, I bawled because I was so goddamn angry and felt powerless. While sobbing, I asked Jordan, "Is this going to be the rest of my life?" I'm not sure why I even asked him. He wasn't out. He was still trying to sort himself out. I got off the phone not long after that. Once I got those tears out of my system, I had effectively shaken off what had bothered me. I never again allowed myself to be as bothered by anything in the barbershop as I was that day. Note, as bothered, which doesn't mean I was cured, but rather that I made a conscious choice to never allow someone else's prejudices to stun me to that extent again. It's not like an old magical white woman came to me and told me bibbidi-bobbidi-boo and made me miraculously immune to anyone's ignorance. Homophobia remained horrific, but as far as my experiences in the barbershop went, I was able to prioritize my grievances. Part of my ability to disassociate myself so swiftly was partially rooted in my not being as easily clocked as other queer men. Not everyone could do that, and I did not pretend otherwise. For me, it remained a defining choice in my life, because while my barber was wrong for laughing at a homophobe claiming all gay men needed to be raped at a woman's prison, there was another problem. He wasn't that damn good of a barber to begin with. He would always cut against the grain, meaning instead of cutting my hair in the direction it was trained to grow, i.e. my wave pattern, he went the opposite way, leaving me waveless. Now, it was my own fault for sticking by him. For a while, I stopped going to him and ended up walking around campus with a big afro that made me look as though I was auditioning to play Huey Freeman in the non-animated version of The Boondocks. As a matter of fact, it wasn't long before I ended up back in his chair. And why? Because I was too lazy to go out and explore another barbershop. I would like to think living in a pre-Yelp social media world excuses me partially, but that would be a lie. As vain as I can be, I don't always make the best decisions about my hair. In fact, there's a ditzy quality to me. I sometimes decide to do things on a whim solely based on natural curiosity. Say, "Oh, I wonder what happens if I put this in reverse. What happens is you nearly crash your car." Or, "She just said I can make that spot, can I?" No, fool, and now your mom has a scratch in her car. There are moments along the lines of, "Oh, I'm allergic to this, but maybe trying it now will be different." The end result is a bitch needing Benadryl. This recklessness and penchant for danger has had an impact on my hair too, which is why for a month, I walked around Los Angeles as Black Mickey Mouse. I had just moved to that Koreatown area of Los Angeles. I knew nothing. I had no car. I didn't have a group of friends there yet. What I did know, though, was that it had been more than a week since I had gotten a haircut, and I couldn't bear the uneven line I saw in the mirror. While walking around the new neighborhood, I saw a barbershop. Mistake number one. I was not in a Black neighborhood, so why would I think they would know how to cut my hair? I did see a Hispanic man there, which made me wonder if he would at least know how to line me up. As I walked up to ask him, he immediately told me that he was getting off. Next to him was a Korean man who didn't speak any English yet motioned for me to come to him anyway. Mistake number two, I sat down in his chair. Mistake number three, I did not immediately get up upon realizing that I was going to let a Korean man who didn't speak English cut my black ass hair. He pointed to a poster of different haircut styles. Mistake number four to infinity. I didn't take this as the Lord telling me to get the hell out of that barbershop and just ask someone to take me to Crenshaw or Inglewood later in the week. All this Korean barber kept saying to me was, "Cut, cut." I was saying, "No, I want you to line it up." I literally took my fingers and showed him what I wanted. He didn't get that right at all. Again, I knew better. My hairline is, was, and forever shall be weird. I have a cowlick, so on one side of the front of my hair has always been oddly thinner, to the point that hair in that area would sometimes just stick up. Over the years, I have had many a barber say to me in befuddlement or annoyance, "Man, it took me longer to line you up than anything else." A barber who knows what he's doing would spot this trouble and delicately cut around the area accordingly. Well, when you don't know how to communicate with the person cutting your hair, you have no real means of making certain that they are careful. The result? On one side of my head, it looked as if someone had forgotten their ruler or any tool that could be used to measure something accurately and opted to use a nylon Toblerone in its place. The line on that side seemed to be headed in two different directions. On the other side, it was straight. But what did it matter when both sides of my head appeared to be in an unholy war? As for the top of my head, not only did he just ram over my cowlick despite me requesting just a lineup, but he also went over the other side of my hair, which up until that moment, I hadn't realized was beginning to thin out in the front too. So, you had a crooked line on one side, a decent enough line on the other, and in the front, a dedication to Mickey Mouse. On top of it all, he took the line so far back that I could reach back and grab my ancestors out of slavery. I had no idea how to say "I'll have to beat your ass" in Korean, but I truly regret not knowing how to convey my rage. When I got home, I immediately took pictures to show people the horror film I had willfully participated in. My mom laughed like hell at me and my idiotic decision. Kim got her chuckles in too. I can't say that I fault either of them. One of my roommates tried to stifle her laughter but gave in, only to follow her chuckles by quipping that I should have told the man that I was Barack Obama, and then maybe I would have gotten a better lineup. Instead, I had walked out of there as a tribute to Sherman Hemsley. For once, I tried to tame my neurotic need for a weekly barbershop visit in order to grow my hair back. I ended up finding another barbershop, one that black folks populated. Upon entering the shop, I spotted one dude in his chair eating a fish plate out of a big styrofoam box. Obviously, I went with him. As I sat down, I immediately said, "Okay, so I let someone mess me up, right?" Instantaneously, he said, "I can tell, bro." That meant it was as bad as I had thought it was, and that my friends had been lying to me to be kind. In this instance, kindness was for suckers. They should have demanded that I go buy a hat. I don't remember anyone saying anything homophobic at that shop, but I do know that after a while I grew tired of this barber asking me if I could write a movie for him. I moved away from Los Angeles, and he sent a friend request on Facebook with a message I never opened. Once I moved to New York, I had to search once again for a competent barber I could depend on to not have me look the fool. Worse, by the time I arrived, I had to deal with the realities that stress, some medication, and bad barbers who didn't take direction well had done to my hair. It was a little thinner on both sides, but the hair continued to grow, only slower than everywhere else. Some people have listened to my complaints and suggested I go bald. Those people can fuck off for all eternity. I still have a lot of hair and a lot of fight left in me, and with God, Rogaine for men, and Jamaican black castor oil, I am still in this. Besides, so long as you channel your Ralph Tresvant and exercise some sensitivity on cutting my hair in the front, we gonna be alright. The first barber I found in Harlem was identical to No Malice from the clips. The shot was on Frederick Douglass, and they had a dog there the size of the Camry I had left back in Texas. He cut my hair alright, but he required too many Amber Alerts to schedule an appointment, so I ditched him. There was a lesbian in the shop that I thought to try, but she left. I later found out it was because the men in the shop were a bit hostile to our clientele, as in all those gay boys. I didn't bother trying anyone else in the shop for that reason alone. I started trying out yet more barbers in the area, and each one was more terrible than the last. Finally, I found D, who looked at my hair, sized up my issues without even me telling him, and told me, "I got you." It was the first time in years I had really been complimented about my cuts. The suggestion to switch to bald fades worked for me, but D kept pressing me to get a Beijing. A Beijing is a semi-permanent hair dye activated by water with progressive product names such as Oriental Black. Every week, D would swear getting a Beijing would settle my insecurities and make me look better. Anytime I seen someone with a Beijing, they look cartoonish. I wouldn't let him do that to me. Had I not suffered enough from barbers over the years? Apparently not, because I went from "that's a nice fade" to "who did that to you? Should I call the police?" He had the lines on the side of my head damn near kissing my earlobes. The first time he did, he apologized and said he'd be more careful. A few weeks later, he fell back on old habits. Of course, this was around the same time he started to complain all the time about being a barber and how much he hated his job. No wonder I started walking around with a forehead far larger than I had ever known it to be. At that point, the only thing that didn't bother me about D was that he never asked about my sexuality. I imagined he knew, but thankfully he avoided a topic I didn't want to engage with him on. He did talk about his women problems to me, all 99,000 of them that essentially amounted to the fact that he had a bit of a wayward dick and the woman he dealt with had issues about it. His shop ended up closing because of the rent increases in New York. I had no idea where D went, but by that time I wanted another barber anyway. He had become too hard to locate on any given day, and while I knew he was a good barber, those few cuts that played with my hairline once again triggered all the self-consciousness I had about getting older and the possibility that my hair might be thinning out to the point that I could no longer present myself the way I wanted to. Again, I'm not shaving my head. Quit telling me to do this. My peanut head is not made for that. I found my most recent and by far best barber since leaving Houston on a whim and in a desperate search to look semi-decent before an audition for an on-camera role on a TV show. It was an incredibly early Tuesday morning in January, and he was standing outside a Big Rush barbershop looking cold. I asked if he could give me a lineup, and as I sat in the chair, I explained what every barber did wrong to my head and what not to do. After seeing how well he took direction, I went ahead and asked for him to give me a full cut. He introduced himself as Khalid and gave me his card, telling me I should come back since I liked the cut so much. So I did. After a while, I noticed that the barbershop was inclusive in both its clientele and its barbers. Until this shop, I had never directly mentioned my sexuality, opting instead to hide in plain sight. Mostly because if I had once again been met with homophobia, I wasn't sure how I would react. The silence that happened a decade prior was no longer going to happen should I be met with that sort of antagonism. I had the sneaking suspicion that if I did confirm that part about me, I wouldn't be made to feel uncomfortable. So much so that when the barber who cut directly in front of Khalid once engaged me in an ongoing conversation about having sex without condoms, I mentioned that I was gay and had long been paranoid about HIV/AIDS, so I'd never had condomless sex. His mind wasn't blown because I said I was gay. He was mystified that I had that level of discipline. Then he told me, "I really hope you get to fuck someone without a condom. It's the best." That's probably the kindest thing anyone has ever said to me inside of a barbershop. For the first time ever, the shop allowed me a glimpse into how straight black men in the shop felt. For them, this was a place of community, or even therapy. For them, the conversations that happened informed their point of view. There are plenty of straight black men who have said to me that the barbershop is partially where they learn how to be a black man in this world. I understand that, but as a black man in this world who happens to be gay, my past experiences will never allow me to share their sentiments. I can never allow myself to feel completely comfortable in those spaces because one, I've had way too many experiences with bad barbers, and two, I've never found those spaces to be welcoming to the sort of man that I am. While I do hope that the younger queer black men who now go into those shops will never have to witness the sort of condemnations I did in years past, my expectations are extremely limited. Now I go in there longing to shake off the sluggish feeling of my untamed name and go back out into the world with the image I prefer to project. I do not go in there to be affirmed. I do not go in there seeking camaraderie. I do not need that place to be my sanctuary because I found mine elsewhere. Ideally, I hope those barbershops become more welcoming to men who are not straight, but it is not a need that I personally have. I enter the space only with the determination to leave feeling beautiful. I know how this world views me as a black person, as a black man, as a gay black man. I'm more than familiar with the hatred fuming on the outside. I am keenly aware of how some of those who look like me view me as beneath them. I wake up every morning having to face them all. I just want to look my best each week when I do. Several months later, I ran into D on the street, right after Khalid gave me a cut. D was on the phone, but told whoever he was talking to, "Let me call you right back." He asked where I had been, as if I ditched him. I explained that I lost his number. "Yes, that sounds like a lie, but I actually did, and word to the wise, never forget the password to your Apple ID and break your phone in the same week." While he complimented my fade, he trashed the lineup and said I needed to come back and see him at the shop a few feet away from us. I didn't really plan to until I went home and looked more deeply into my hair. He was right. I went back to him the following week. Pray for my hair. Itchy and scratchy. "Your dick is dry," Chris declared in an exquisitely executed matter-of-fact fashion. He was not wrong. It had been at least 2 years since I had had sex. Still, the bitch could have been more sensitive. Counterpoint, sensitivity is for Ralph Tresvant and people who can't always handle the truth. I was in obvious need of at least 3 tablespoons of truth serum, and Chris proved willing and able to serve me some. And so he did, over discounted well brown liquor at an East Village dive bar. I had moved and settled into life in New York, but true to form, my focus was much more on getting settled, making money. Freelancers are always worried about making money because you never know when a contract will be cut, or some editor who just a week ago said you were everything mentions the words budget slash. And working toward a future that didn't include me essay hustling so much as getting laid. I had squandered my 20s by not having enough sex. If I were to rate my sex life in that decade through emojis now, I behaved like the yellow one with his eyes closed and a straight line where a smile should be. I should have acted more like a cross between the eggplant and the one nobody I know uses to signify actual raindrops. I had plenty of hoe moments, to be sure, but inconsistency over 10 years riddled with the guilt that came with religious indoctrination and lingering insecurities had been the norm. Insert here that emoji that looks like someone gasping for air in utter agony. I told myself that my 30s would be different. In fact, I wrote a whole essay about it. Rest in peace to XO Jane and its series of It Happened to Me essays. I never got to write one of those, but when the remarkable Rebecca Carroll was editing the site, I did pen a piece about my struggles with intimacy, the source of that anxiety, and my resolution to letting go of past trauma and inhibitions and starting to have sex without all the emotional baggage I had been carrying. After my piece was published, strangers online were encouraging in a "you go boy, don't press eject on your erections anymore" sort of way. I also ended up talking about the piece on NPR with the Michelle Martin. Michelle Martin is so brilliant and so classy, which meant I spoke about the matter in a Tell Me More segment entitled Black, Gay, and Scared of Sex in as similar a manner as possible. I didn't master the talk radio voice, but I did manage to avoid being crass and saying something like, "Sis, I gotta quit bullshitting and get to the nuts. Gold star for me." But I could talk about my sex life with Chris like that. My bluntness gave way to an even more direct reaction from him. He was pointed in his critique, telling me that I should learn to carve out a little more personal time to bust a nut because it was healthy to have sex. It was also becoming a bit obvious that I needed something to lower my rising stress levels, which were sooner or later going to lead me to spontaneously combusting. He advised me to be a better gay and have sex without having to engage in the getting to know you process. He had a suggestion on how to accomplish such a feat, going on the apps. I immediately rolled my eyes when he said it. Hookup apps like Jack and Grindr were an acquired taste, and for the longest time, I had no interest in acquiring that taste. Some people loathe those sorts of apps for ruining romance and contributing to the decline of the art of conversation. So, about this. I, too, like the idea of two people meeting, connecting on some emotional, spiritual, whatever phrasing constitutes deeper connection level, and going on to have amazing sex. To me, that gives way to the sort of fucking that leads to good loving, body rocking, knocking boots all night long, yeah, making love until we tire to the break of dawn. But as I was learning with my sandy penis, there were also times that call for sex more along the lines of, "Only ring your celly when I'm feeling lonely. When it's all over, please get up and leave." I made peace with that, but I wasn't sure if attaining the latter through an app was my kind of thing. I didn't think of myself as pure, but partaking in the apps, which screamed seamless for sex, felt degrading. Then I had to check myself. Would using an app to have sex be all that different from the years I had spent on Instant Messenger and the direct message sections of various message boards? What had I been doing on Instant Messenger and the direct message sections of various message boards? Being a junior varsity cyber slut ass hoe, that's what. Back when I had peak fear of intimacy and dying from complications related to some incurable sexually transmitted disease, I did some questionable things, depending on what god you serve and dogma you adhere to. Those would include doing virtual peep shows for people on camera as Michael O2808 with a Logitech camera purchased from Best Buy. Nothing was ever recorded, or at least I didn't think it was. I guess I'll find out when I launch my senatorial campaign sometime in my 6th decade of life. As much shame as I felt each and every time I engaged in virtual ho shit, overall, I can't say that I regret any of it. In a lot of ways, it helped me. It gave me validation as a sexual desirable being. If I could see the benefit of engaging in sexual voyeurism with a gleeful half-black boy living in Amsterdam and bonding over our similar tastes in 90s and early aughts R&B acts, why not see the benefits of apps? If AOL and Yahoo Messenger had functioned as my virtual whoring, weren't the apps just dotting in 3D? The more I thought about it, the more my hesitation waned, and I eventually had a change of heart. It took a minute for me to truly engage with these apps, however. Initially, I would log on and promptly punk out with the underlying concern that motherfuckers were crazy out here. Ultimately, I finally gave in and signed up for Jack, which was described as a gay man's social network. Okay, sure. It was a rocky experience for me from the jump. The first person that came over just performed fine work with his mouth and was promptly sent on his way. Once he finished and exited, I couldn't find my keys. I sprinted to my paranoia and was certain that he had stolen my keys and was planning to return to my apartment to slit my throat. Hours went by, and I cursed the state of New York for not having loose gun laws like Texas did. Naturally, this was happening the day before New Year's Eve, meaning my super was off for the next couple of days. As for calling a locksmith, well, there were two doors you had to go through in order to get into my building, so me changing the locks on both was not an option. At the time, I didn't know many of my neighbors. The dude who kept saying, "Well, when you and the white people moved in," to my immediate objection, "My nigga, I would be living in Harlem regardless, so don't lump me in with folks who discovered Harlem 4 minutes ago after reading about just how lovely it is now in the New York Times." The black woman who looked like the older second cousin of Maxine Shaw from Living Single, the unfriendly white gay dude who lived in the unit between us, and that louder woman downstairs who remembered my name, though I could never remember hers. I just called her Drunk Millie Jackson in my mind. She was particularly unreliable. She was always banging on my window to let her in all the time. She constantly woke me up arguing with her man, whom she swore she was over but who never left. Whenever he put her out, or she lost her keys in between her eighth glass of E&J and third Marlboro of the evening, she would bug me to let her in. "Anthesai, Michael." A lie. None of these people seemed to be home. So, for hours, I contemplated my new life as that fool who had trapped himself in the apartment for days because he was horny and allowed some man to show him exactly what that mouth do. Some writers can be hermits who lock themselves in their places of residence for days at a time. I'm not that person. But even if I were, that should only be an option rather than a scenario forced upon you. After all this drama, I ended up finding my keys in one of my kitchen cabinets while I was trying to locate a pan to bake the chicken nuggets I planned to have for emotional eating purposes. What actually made me feel the fool about all of this was that the guy turned out to be best friends with a man I would spot several months later and immediately fall for. This man was gorgeous, smart, incredibly talented, creative, kind, and of course, from Louisiana. A southern experience I could easily relate to. God rest my stunning grandma's soul, but he was the sort of man that even if she had a problem with her grandsons being gay, she would have looked at this man and said, "Well, if you're gonna be a homo, this is the way to do it." It was too perfect, which is exactly why I screwed it up from the very beginning. Of course, when we eventually hung out, he didn't mention that his bestie had told him much more than, "We went on a date once." In fact, he had told him everything. Because as that guy had already proven, it was hard for him to close his mouth. Fuck him forever for being a hater and not allowing me the chance to scare his friend away on my own terms. There were other problems too. Although I was using the screen name Slim Shady on Jack, the anonymity often afforded to users wasn't going so well for me. I was getting messages like, "Hey Michael, I love your blog, The Cynical Ones. You've been such an inspiration to me." Then I started being asked if I was at Young Cynic from Twitter, and again came conversations about my work as a writer. It hadn't dawned on me that to some, namely those younger than me or around the same age I was, who largely populated this app, I was one of the few working gay black writers they might know of. When I shared this with my friend Alex, he said, "I don't get why you feel like you wouldn't get recognized. You're an openly gay journalist who writes everything everywhere. All these Negroes aren't illiterate, ignorant bottoms." Fair. On one hand, it was flattering to be recognized and to be complimented on my work. Having said that, that wasn't really the point of my being on the app. To this day, I've yet to get hard over someone complimenting me on one of my essays. Not to mention, while I had gotten over my own stigma against the apps, the same could not be said of others. I worried that being clocked would lead to people drawing certain conclusions about me, that they would judge me. Soon, someone I was interested in said that someone else had screen-capped a conversation of mine from Jack and posted it in some Facebook group. I didn't know what the group was for. It was probably for bitches that couldn't mind their own business. I never asked what people were saying about my conversation. I just immediately deleted the app. A month later, I reinstalled it, then days later deleted again. I repeated that cycle for a while, as so many of us do. In between deleting after masturbating or reinstalling when that wasn't enough, there did end up being one person who was more than just a one-off. I didn't know his name. I never cared to learn it. He never knew mine, which is what I had intended. He came over for one reason, and when we finished, I sent him on his way. For the sake of following along, I'll call him Itchy. In the summer of 2015, I had a bedbug scare. Before moving to New York City, I didn't know a solitary thing about bedbugs. Upon moving here, I learned that bedbugs were some sort of real-life monsters under your bed, only far worse, because these demonic beasts could attack every inch of your mattress and various parts of your body. Guess who woke up one damn day in July with huge red bumps on his left leg and the top areas of his back? The bumps on my knees and lower back were as big as the head of that star of the cartoon series Bobby's World. As in big as fuck. There were also bites from my knee down to my ankle. I immediately took pictures and sent them to my mama, whom I consult for every medical emergency. She didn't know what the hell was on my leg and back. She thought maybe it was some sort of spider. Then it hit her and me at the same damn time. Are these the damn bites of those disgusting ass bugs? I saw no signs of them anywhere, so it was difficult to prove. I did drop an email to my landlord about it. He sent the super, who checked out my apartment, specifically the bed, and saw no signs of the pest. He came back with one of those bug bombs. I had read about those sorts of contraptions and how they didn't work on bed bugs at all. So he dropped that little bomb on me and had me out of my place for hours to fix a problem with the wrong equipment. What could go wrong? 2 weeks went by, and I ended up not having any more bite marks. Not long after, I saw more bites in a similar pattern on my left leg, as well as the top of my right arm. Frantic, I threw out a ton of things in my apartment, the bedspread, the sheets, the pillowcases, and a ton of clothes. The clothes I did keep, I went down the street and tossed them in the dryer to kill whatever bugs may have gotten on them, and then I stuffed them in multiple garbage bags. I also enclosed my mattress in one of those weird plastic things that's supposed to keep bed bugs out. Most of this was semi-reasonable, but I have a habit of behaving like a full-fledged fool when frantic. I couldn't get over the sight of those hideous bumps on my skin, so I put toothpaste on them. Why would I be so dumb? Well, my logic was that toothpaste could get rid of pimples, so maybe they could get rid of these too. Yeah, I have 3 marks on my leg that are basically burning stains from that. As successful as the cocoa butter had been in returning my skin to its usual presentation after sitting on a fire ant bed in Houston, I didn't have as much luck with it when it came to my decision to deal with this latest setback. When I finally met with a dermatologist, she charged me way too much money to say that she couldn't confirm that the bites had come from bed bugs because in New York City, it could have been anything. She prescribed me a cream, but she could have saved me a copay and travel had she just filled my prescription when I called her. A month and change went by, and there were no bites. I couldn't figure out the source of the problem. Was it the train? Was it the Magic Johnson Theater? Was it my gym? I had no idea until I let Itchy come through again. Sexual eruptions were not happening in the midst of this, so when Itchy came over, it was intended to be a much-needed release. The next morning, the bumps were back. That's when I realized it was this man. I confided to my friend La, a person I love but who was also someone who lived to troll me no matter the circumstance. I told her that I had been getting these bumps that could be from bed bugs, but since I never found any, I could not know for certain. She went in. Nigga, are you fucking somebody with fleas? It was via text, but I could feel her laughter through my iPhone. I didn't know where she had gotten flea bites from, but after quickly Googling to find out what flea bites look like, I decided that that may have been the case. I was beyond embarrassed. All I ever wanted was a release, and I ended up with a prescription, a torn up apartment, and the loss of a lot of clothes that I couldn't even get a tax write-off for because I didn't want to be responsible for spreading the evil. For the record, the dude didn't look dirty. I mean, he seemed like he smoked weed as much as I drank water, but there were plenty of squeaky clean weed heads. Needless to say, I laid off the apps for a significant time. Once I did go back on, about a year later, guess who clocked me on Grindr? He wanted to come over, and what did I say? Have you bathed at least 4 times today? Have you burned every article of clothing you've owned within the past 12 years? Have you burned your place of residence down in the name of the anti-bug movement? No, I didn't say any of that. I thought to simply block him and delete the app all over again and go catch up on the dozens of articles in my Pocket app that deservingly felt abandoned. But in the end, I let him come over, but only to give me head. I tried to rationalize it all. I would pull my sheets away. I would spray the mattress down as soon as he left. I would turn on gospel music and pray for an hour that I didn't wake up once again being the scratchy to his itchy. Right before he came by, I knew how pathetic I was being. I was disgusted with myself. Still, I let him blow me anyway. It was not worth it. I put my balls at risk. What if whatever had been crawling on him had planned to finish me off by attacking one of my testicles and kill me? I looked in the mirror, stared deep into myself, and wondered aloud, "What in the fuck is wrong with you, Michael?" I was not protecting my sack or my spirit. I knew better, and it was time to act like it. After that, I gracefully bowed out of regular usage of the apps. When I say regular usage, I mean that between the final 36 hours of 2013 and early fall 2015, I would go on there every now and again for, stuff. After that, I downloaded them whenever I wanted to be reminded of how awful men were. Then I joined Tinder, which is where you match with attractive people to go on actual dates. Although, fun fact, most of the people you match would have no real interest in conversation, much less meeting in person. As fate would have it, I would later become a columnist at Into, a digital magazine for the modern queer world launched by Grindr. I never told the editor-in-chief, Zach Stafford, that I may or may not have been exposed to fleas in the past by using one of the apps, and that I considered the column to be my reparations. Despite somehow finding myself once again at the intersection of vengeful insects and fornication, I do like that I allowed myself the space to let go of certain hang-ups I held about the apps and applauded myself for not denying human instinct. But every now and then, I see the scars on my left leg and remember that I always have to be good to my balls, for they have always been so good to me. My Lord and Gyrator. My father was a presence in my life, for better and for worse, but there were things no straight man, much less one like him, could teach a little boy who was into boys. The fishing trips were fun. I also liked swinging and kicking on the punching bag he pinned up in the garage for me and my little brother. I enjoyed all of the designated boy things he introduced me to, but he probably clocked other characteristics about me, only he dared not speak about them. And despite my undoubtedly being my mother's son in many ways, I could tell that she had similar blind spots. This is not a shot at them. They understood life as they had been raised to view it, and that vision did not extend to little boys with certain traits that may or may not have raised eyebrows. It was easier to cater to the more aggressive, traditionally masculine aspects of me than it was to those that came across as softer, feminine, girly. It didn't help much that I wasn't able to get out and explore life in my teenage years in the way that many teens have the opportunity to do. My mother was strict, and there was only so much I could do, and as a result, see and experience. In such a state of confinement, I found pop culture to be a saving grace. For many who lack access financially, emotionally, physically, or some combination of the three, pop culture is how we get to access perspectives from outside our bubbles. It helps to inform us of who we are in our present, developing who we ultimately might become. The man I've become has largely been molded by the lessons learned from the famous women I've obsessed over throughout the course of my life. My mother told me that she explained sex to me when I was 3. Unsurprisingly, it was in the context of procreation. She reminded me of this fact 10 years later when I was 13. While walking to the refrigerator, probably to have my 11th sausage sandwich, I made some quip in response to some talk show segment related to teenage pregnancies. I asked her when she had first told me about sex, and that's when she reminded me. It made sense to me, because I couldn't recall not ever knowing about sex, or at least how babies were made. Now, when I was 13, my mom quickly followed up with how to put a condom on. I was like, "All right now, mama, I'm not having sex." It wasn't so much that she encouraged me to have sex. In fact, her position was a staunch don't do it. Still, she was a nurse who, for decades, primarily took care of new mothers, including incredibly young ones. Fortunately for her fears of becoming a grandmother far too soon, I was getting fat and developing a complex. There was also the whole thing where Kenneth in honors biology, not Kim, was looking appealing to me. My mom's medical background provided a technical explanation of a specific kind of sex. As for my dad, we have never, ever talked about sex. He warned me repeatedly in my childhood to never get married, but when it came to talking about sex, not a single remark. Perhaps that was why, as most of my teachers from K-12 were women, I always looked to them as authorities, sources of information on how things were. Having said that, neither my mother nor any other woman or man around me spoke about sex outside of the sentiment, "Ho, don't do it," and lamentations about unplanned pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases. And no one said anything outside the prism of vaginal sex. And absolutely no one spoke of sex in terms of pleasure. Around the same time my mom mentioned condoms, I went to a record store called Soundwaves to purchase T-Boz of TLC's first solo single, the pro-masturbation anthem Touch Myself. According to the poster of the Ten Commandments that used to hang on the wall in the room I shared with my younger brother, a poster featuring a white man with graying hair and surprisingly good muscle definition, masturbation was adultery, and per that, adultery was in violation of the Seventh Commandment. T-Boz had a solid counter-argument. "I don't think it's wrong to touch yourself. Ain't nothing wrong with making it feel good." It did indeed feel good. Thus the point went to T-Boz and Deborah Keeling singing background vocals, with apologies to Moses. Then there was Lil' Kim, who rapped, "I used to be scared of the dick, now I throw lips to the shit," on the iconic Big Mama thing. Granted, I was a wee bit late to fully embrace the lyric, but it spoke to me all the same. Listening to women talk about sex felt right, because we shared a similar interest in men. There was only so much you could glean from men singing about women in ways that, try as you might have, just didn't appeal to you. I love the way Mr. Dalvin from Jodeci looked in the Come and Talk to Me, Radio Remix, and Cry For You videos, but I just wanted his clothes and wondered what he looked like underneath them. I can also say this about so many other singers and rappers. Kim, Trina, and Foxy Brown objectified men in ways that I could relate to. Even openly gay male singers of that era, and our current one, largely ignored overt expressions of their desire. So, these women appealed to me, because what else did I have? Furthermore, these women were ostracized for being so sexual. Their behavior was taboo, just like gay sex. So when it came to sex, my mother had taught me the mechanics, but female recording artists filled the gaps. That was the only real kind of sex ed I'd ever had. As far as visible depictions and musings about homosexuality went, Janet Jackson and Madonna each informed me about sex, but also taught me much more than merely the act of sex. I didn't know anything about ball scenes from the 80s and 90s, but I did have a chance to see black and Latino men in their element by way of Vogue. I was far too young to understand the politics behind Madonna's tapping into that subculture for her art at the time, but I did know it was through Madonna that I saw my first images of non-white gay men that didn't come across as caricature. That and Living Color sketch Men On, in which Damon Wayans and David Alan Grier portray Blaine Edwards and Antoine Meyer Rather, respectively, scared me as a child. With Madonna, the men looked free. On that show, they looked like fools. The slightest semblance of femininity from a black man warranted that degree of ridicule. You don't forget that kind of idea when it's presented to you in such a direct, mocking way. Madonna offered a counterpoint, even if it was one I wouldn't lean on until I was older. Similarly, since I didn't have the language to properly challenge the religion in which I was raised, through Madonna, a recovering Catholic herself, I was at least introduced to the novel concept that it was reasonable to look at religion and challenge what you've been told to believe. My catechism teachers had no idea she was the culprit behind my many, many questions during CCE classes. Janet Jackson was probably the most impactful pop star of my K-12 years. In elementary school, I used to wear these green denim shorts, think pond, not lime, emerald, or feces green, and in homage to her, I would wear their top button undone. Sometimes, hateful teachers would demand that I button myself all the way up. My love for Janet's background dancer, Omar Lopez, is well known among my close friends. But when I think about albums like The Velvet Rope, I remember a period during which she slapped me with so many heavy topics that I wasn't at all ready to handle but nonetheless needed to hear. I didn't know how to describe these sad feelings inside of me, but at least she provided a partial soundtrack to them. And her musings weren't confined to sex. She sang about domestic violence as I continued to remain silent about what I had witnessed in my own home. Most people would assume that when I first heard Free Zone, the closeted gay in me gleamed as a woman I practically worship sang out against homophobia. The same about Together Again, a track dedicated to friends Janet had lost to AIDS. No and no. On the contrary, those songs freaked me the fuck out. I could listen to the DJ Premier remix of Together Again because the shit slapped, but I actively tried to ignore the messaging behind it. Free Zone boasted lyrics such as boy meets boy, boy loses boy, boy gets cute boy back. So I would skip that track and turn on My Need. I would fantasize about boys and then feel guilty, fearing I was hellbound if I ever acted on those feelings. All of these women introduced me to themes and affirming imagery and messaging early on. Indeed, many of the lessons came before I had left high school. Still, I had yet to go out into the world and figure out my own place in it. Little by little, as I grew more comfortable with myself, the nuggets they had dropped were picked back up, and I found greater meaning in them. Nevertheless, when I think about the last and most impactful pop culture figure of my life, I think of my Lord and Gyrator, Beyoncé Giselle Knowles Carter. She is the beginning, end, and body role to me. I have loved this woman from the very first Destiny's Child video. Long before you other folks banded together to launch the Beehive, I was setting the stones for the building that housed our meetings with the other true believers. When I listen to Beyoncé, I hear home. Like me, she went to Welch Middle School and probably heard boys and girls doing the same slow, hazy kind of flow heard on songs such as Lil Kiki's Pimp the Pen and Big Mo's Bar Baby during lunch in the cafeteria. I know Beyoncé is someone who listened to 97.9 The Box and heard the same New Orleans bounce mixes played throughout the day. I'm sure of it, because Give Me Body sounds like something by someone who grew up routinely hearing DJ Jubilee's Get It Ready and loved it so much that she wanted to create something that would both pay homage and offer her own spin to it. When Beyoncé does her choreography, she reminds me of the same majorettes I saw at Madison High School, Yates High School, and Willow Ridge High School football games. That's why she's always on beat, because majorettes never, ever miss a beat. I love that she has remained country as hell and country in a way that is very specific to a black girl born in Houston but with Louisiana roots. I love that when R&B began to decline on radio, she never picked up a glow stick and joined the EDM wave like so many others fighting to stay relevant. Obviously, she made this choice long after she had cemented her place in music and culture, but there's still something admirable about a black woman foregoing trends that pander to white people at the expense of black creativity. As a black creative, I know all too well what it's like to be urged to tone down who you are, sold under the pretense that it broadens your appeal to the mainstream. I didn't have to wait for the Beyoncé and Lemonade albums to know Beyoncé was pro-black, because choosing to stand firm in who you are and the culture that shaped you is a testament to caring about blackness, black culture, and black people. As a writer who has existed in mainstream media and black media alike, I know how much more the former means to many people than the latter, regardless of their race or ethnicity. So even if only on a symbolic level, Beyoncé's stance on remaining exactly as she's always been, no matter what is happening around her, has instilled in me the strength to remain the Gulf Coast ratchet bird I am. Yet, when I think about what Beyoncé most means to me, I think of my friend once saying, "You dance like a faggot." Janine, a lesbian and a dear friend, once shouted it out from the backseat of my car as I danced perhaps far too aggressively while driving to the club. She meant it as a compliment, which she quickly noted after seeing the visible discomfort on my face. For an extremely long time, I didn't dance publicly because it was one of the characteristics that I always felt was a dead giveaway about my queerness. I never wanted to be perceived like Blaine Edwards and Antoine Meriwether, or any of the other gay men in various films and television shows who played similar depictions of the effeminate gay black man, whose only real duty was to service those who want to laugh at a sissy. I remember my mom driving me home from school once and out of the blue remarking, "Some people probably mock the way you walk and the way you talk." At the time, that had not yet started to happen, but by the time I entered middle school, it was indeed an issue. Sometimes I took the insults in stride, other times I swung on their asses. It depended on the question of how much I wanted to let it get to me. The answer depended on my mood, and my mood was typically shaped by the degree of madness coming from my father at home. As for how I walk, I haven't the slightest idea. I don't know. I've never organized a focus group or had someone record me in motion for analysis. I don't think I walk with a twist. I don't think I strut. Honestly, I have flat, skinny feet, and unless I'm wearing a pair of tennis shoes, pardon my country, sneakerheads, that fit just right, my feet normally hurt, and that's largely been my only focus when I walk. When it comes to how I talk, that too is subjective. For the most part, I speak in a monotonous tone. As a Houstonian, many of us, much like Beyonce, speak with a slower cadence. Louisiana is a few hours away. Both sides of my family are rooted there, and some, depending on where they are from, can talk at much faster speeds. My dad is from a teensy town in Texas, but he speaks with the speed of a Category 5 hurricane. The more engaged I am, or, as I've learned since the age of 21, the drunker I am, the faster I talk and my voice goes a lot higher. In my final year of college, I had to take a news vision course to complete my degree in broadcast journalism. That included me planning and shooting my own segments to be presented for the class. I remember the reaction to the first three I had to do. No one besides the two students from New Orleans could make out what I was saying. I spoke fast and high and befuddled the rest of the folks in the course. It was so bad that Professor Lewis, who liked me but wanted me to be coherent, offered a tip. Tap your feet and speak with the pace of those slower taps, Speedy Gonzalez. This helped me a bit, but I also tended to speak with my hands, a trait that read as feminine. I used to hate the sound of my voice, and I used to hate watching video of me, seeing how I performed all these actions that registered as gay. That's why, as much as I enjoy tracks like Vogue, I certainly didn't dance to them in public. In fact, I didn't dance in public at all. That was why, when Janine said that I danced like a faggot, I paused for a second. It was something I needed to get over, and learning to shake off that stigma came with a soundtrack. Beyonce's majorly up-tempo and entirely glorious 2006 album, B-Day. One of my favorite videos from the pre-visual album era was for Freakum Dress. I loved how much that video recalled Vanity 6 and Apollonia 6, groups that I had learned by way of my big sister. As in the old Madonna videos and tours, there were gay black men acting completely and utterly femme, and completely comfortable with that femininity. So, when I started hearing Freakum Dress in the club, or hell, while walking on a sidewalk, I stopped fighting the urge not to react in public the way I did in private. The same went for the bonus tracks on the album like Back Up and Lost Your Mind, which gay black clubs played obsessively in cities such as Houston, New York, Washington, D.C., and Atlanta. When Dangerously in Love came out, I used to do the choreography to Baby Boy in the oversized dorm room I had my sophomore year of college. It was a shame I didn't do it in public where it counted. Let's be clear that I'm not really coordinated enough to perform full-out choreography. I'll say that it's not impossible, but it would take me too long to learn the steps because my attention span blows with the wind and I'd rather just dance like a free-spirited thought. Aaliyah, my very first friend at Howard, once told me at Club Love in D.C., rest in peace, during our junior year, after I was out and ready to twerk, "Yo, Mike, you dance like a stripper and the rent is due." God, what a sweet soul she is. I keep it in my back pocket whenever I need to pull out a pick-me-up in this awful world we live in. Naturally, when Aaliyah said this, I was dancing to Beyonce. I don't dance like that as much anymore because I'm getting older and worry about my knees, but every now and then, I remember to stretch and prove I still have it in me. Some of this comes from inner strength, but obviously that inner strength was instilled in me by Our Lady of Creole Goodness, Beyonce. Ugh, I love her so much. I actually met Beyonce once in 2011 in Los Angeles, which was the site of that year's NBA All-Star Game. It was at some CAA party that I was able to go to as the plus one of my friend Candy. It had been a long time coming. When I was an intern at the radio station in Houston in 2003, no one had told me that Beyonce was going to be there and that I could have come to fall on my knees and honor my savior. I only knew it was happening because while en route to Mass on a Saturday evening, I got a text like, "Why aren't you here?" Because none of you selfish jackasses told me, that's why. Fuck, 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 fuck. No, I will never forgive them. We could have met that day and bonded over a shared love of papados and fried alligator. She could have gotten so smitten with me that she would have just told me to get in the car with her team and make a living carrying her purse. I would have said, "Hell yes, Miss Massa." 8 years later, I finally got to bow before the presence of greatness. It took a minute to get in. The fire marshal was being spiteful by putting our safety first and not allowing more people in. J. Cole was standing outside with the rest of us until he went around to another entrance for famous people who didn't care about the fire code. Eventually, we made our way inside. It was packed as hell, and as we were making our way through the crowd to find the free alcohol these rich people were providing, I heard Candy shout, "Michael, Beyonce is coming this way." I turned into the fastest sprinter on the planet and bypassed the lessers to make my way to glory. While rushing, I spotted Ryan Phillippe, who under any other circumstances would have warranted my full attention, but but I had to walk on by his fine ass because I was on a mission. Candy pointed in the direction of Beyonce, and I rushed that way. As soon as I spotted her, I did what any reasonable person would do. I started bowing. I couldn't do a complete drop because there were way too many people, but I did the best I could to pay homage. I think she appreciated it. So I tapped her and said, "I'm from Houston." Then she looked at me and smiled. "You from Houston?" I went, "Yeah, and actually my brother went to Johnson with Solange, same year." She touched me after and was like, "That's cool." She was not being fake about it either. Her smile and the way she raised her voice in response were genuine. Then she smiled at me and touched my shoulder. Now, when Oprah had spoken at my college graduation, I had felt my credit score rising, but this was much more spiritual than that. I immediately felt like I was a better man. I asked for a hug, and she hugged me. She was leaving the party, so after the embrace, she floated away, and Candy just kept repeating, "Oh my God." I should note that Jay-Z was standing behind Beyonce the whole time. As much as I love Jay-Z, I am a gay black man from Houston, Texas, so my focus was on her, not him. Hours after it happened, a friend of mine asked, "Did you act like a stan or did you act like a normal person?" What a ridiculous question. Of course I acted like a stan. If you don't act like a stan when you meet Beyonce, something is wrong with you. I wasn't about to play it cool like she was a pope or something. No, 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 parts 1 and 2. By the way, the person who asked this was a Beatheist. A Beatheist is someone who denies the splendor of Beyonce. I don't get people like that. I feel like they have a disability that's somehow contagious, which is why I developed a rule to stop dating men who dislike Beyonce. I have tried to respect other people's religious beliefs, but sometimes the biases you develop are well earned. I've learned my lesson when it comes to Beatheists. They're garbage human beings who don't deserve to be around someone like me, a person with much better taste in music, a wiser embrace of excellence, and a champion of a black woman who never let a beat beat her out. Can I get a no. I wish I could have talked to Beyonce longer, though. I wish I could have told her what an impact she's had on my life, how she motivates me with her work ethic, how her music brings the kind of joy that I can barely put into words, and yes, how her femininity made me comfortable with the parts of me that read as feminine, and how I found that to be a source of strength, maybe even more than the other side, because masculinity is never put down the way femininity can be. It shouldn't have taken me so long to accept that side. The strongest people I know are my mother, my sister, and other women I've been fortunate enough to befriend along the way. So many women provided insight into my sexuality in my formative years, but even in my appreciation for them as complex, strong, phenomenal women, I made the mistake of not seeing their femininity as so vital an influence on me. Beyonce was the one who helped me understand this, and in the end, she gave me the confidence to fully accept all parts of myself. These days, I like to describe myself as someone sitting at the intersection of Beyonce and Bun B. She'll know what I mean. She's from Houston. It's probably too late to become besties. If it's not, let the record show that I would happily sign whatever NDA is required to be around her. The same goes for human sacrifices. I would like to think I will cross paths with her again. Ideally, it would be at Papa Do's at 610, the one closest to me, and the one she used to always go to. We would sit over a lot of fried alligator and so many swamp things, and I would tell her everything. And I would thank her, because if not for her and the other women I've admired over time, I wouldn't be this man I enjoy being now. I feel like she'd get that. And if that never happens, I will continue to say thanks as I always do, by giving her whatever dollar amount she requires of me for great seats at our concerts, where I dance proudly, without fear or worry. The Marrying Con. If it were to ever happen, I have long had a working idea of how it all would go. After months of working out with an annoying but highly effective trainer I found on Instagram who I thought was sexy but turned out to be straight, I will try to respect his lifestyle choices. I will achieve my goal in creating the sort of body I've always dreamed of having. I don't necessarily mean perfect IG thought physique, but I will no longer have the love handles with which I developed a codependent relationship with back in my chubbier years. As a result of those lofty goals being met, you will find me standing in front of the mirror, freakishly observing myself in a ridiculously expensive suit that I hopefully didn't pay for minutes before the ceremony is to begin. If it's perfectly. Yes, I am being self-involved, but in light of the event at hand, I'm well within my right to stun on you hoes. The selfies will soon commence, only to be interrupted by various friends joining together to screech, "Bitch, get over yourself. We need to start." After their reality check is cashed,